This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Liam Fox and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. We'll take a look at the big stories from the region over the past week. Coming up, villagers in Vanuatu take legal action over their polluted lagoon. Confusion in Samoa around the voting eligibility of overseas citizens, and a group of women in PNG overcome odds to become helicopter pilots. We'll have more on those stories coming up. First, Tuvalu's government says it will ratify a landmark security treaty with Australia, ending months of speculation over concerns the treaty would affect the Pacific nation's sovereignty. It comes as residents of the low-lying atoll nation recover from devastating king tides, with some describing it as the worst they've seen. Doug Dingwall reports.
Angela Telepe's backyard on Tuvalu's main island of Funafuti is usually a place for her family to have picnics, but in February it went underwater.
It just reaches the step, but it covers this whole area, like, as you can see, the kids can swim in the water because of the king tide.
The king tide covered the area, damaging her crops and flooding nearby homes.
Our neighbor's house, the one of my relatives live in, they live to the shoreline. They had to evacuate because of the strong wind and plus the king tide. They had to evacuate because the water was coming right inside. The waves were just washing inside the house.
The February king tide grew larger with heavy rainfall and strong winds and waves, damaging the main road on Funafuti. Authorities say the king tides hit areas not affected in previous years. It was followed weeks later by another tide rise. All this took place as Tuvalu considered the Falapilla Union Treaty, which would let its people escape the impacts of climate change by migrating to Australia. Prime Minister Feletti Teo says his government is ratifying the treaty, despite concerns about a clause allowing Australia to veto any security agreements Tuvalu makes with any other country.
So the new administration has undertaken to proceed with the treaty with the assurance that provision will never be abused by Australia. Most Tuvaluans, if you ask them, they don't want to leave Tuvalu, they want to stay here. But for their own reason that decides to move, I think it's the government's responsibility to create those pathways for them to be able to migrate with dignity rather than being compelled and forced to leave.
Australian National University climatologist Mark Howden says sea level rise is accelerating and will change how king tides affect communities.
The tides themselves are caused by movements of the moon relative to the earth, and that isn't particularly influenced by climate change. But what does happen is as the sea level rises on average, so that the sea level goes up, it means that any given king tide could go further inland than it otherwise would, causing more floods than it otherwise would.
He says it's still possible for Tuvalu to remain inhabitable into the future if the world rapidly decreases its greenhouse gas emissions. But the king tides this year had Tuvaluans like Angela Telepe questioning their future in their homeland as sea levels rise with climate change.
I think it's a good opportunity also for my people to see another way that Australia is offering a better pathway.
While some Tuvaluans are open to migrating to Australia if they have to, they fear it could come at a cost to their culture. Former Tuvalu Prime Minister and current MP, Enele Sopoanga, says there's a need to protect the rights of Tuvalu to exist as a nation and community, regardless of climate change.
Relocation in that regard, it could be an option, but, you know, relocation in the process under which and through which the Tuvalu nation will remain as Tuvalu, and therefore Tuvalu will continue to enjoy its full rights, social rights, cultural rights, and fundamental human rights to be able to exist as a nation, as a community of Tuvalu. Whether these things are being taken care of by the Falapilla Union, I'm not sure.
The Office of Australia's Pacific Minister, Pat Conroy, did not comment when approached. However, the treaty would recognise Tuvalu's continuing statehood in the face of climate change. Prime Minister Filetiteo believes Tuvaluans can keep their culture alive if they move to Australia.
Doug Dingwall with that report. In Vanuatu, villagers living beside Errakor Lagoon near Port Vila are planning to take the government to court for environmental neglect. They can't swim or fish in the lagoon because it's been heavily polluted by untreated sewage. The villagers have been trying to restore the waters to their former health, but say the government needs to play its part. Leia Luwanbu has the story.
The once turquoise waters of Errakor Lagoon are now grey. People used to swim and fish there, but that's been banned because the water is highly contaminated with harmful bacteria. One of the chiefs of Errakor village, Ken Andrew, says his community has been trying to restore its beauty, but it's too big a job.
Little organizations that we're setting up, we still continue to pick up all these plastic bags and all this to clean up the lagoon, but we got no power. We have not enough power because we are cleaning, but they're still polluting people. They're polluting the lagoon.
The biggest source of pollution comes from the nearby Port Vila Central Hospital. Its sewage flows directly into Errakor Lagoon untreated.
The worst one is the hospital. We already make like investigations and all those, and we find out that when you press the flush toilet and the dirty plates and all those stuffs inside the sink, direct to the lagoon. There's no more way to stop.
Chief Kalmara Kalo's community lives next to where the hospital's sewage discharges into the lagoon. He remembers when people used to go fishing in the lagoon.
People who don't have a job use the lagoon to earn money, but with the pollution, they no longer can do that. But if the government takes action to stop this pollution, the lagoon will be clean again and people can start earning their living.
He too wants to see it cleaned up.
If we block the sewage drainage system of businesses close to the lagoon and the hospital, I believe the lagoon will return to how it was in the past. We would be able to eat shells and fishes.
Locals like Willie Silverio are trying to restore the lagoon's health by collecting rubbish in the lagoon and planting mangroves.
The Bridge Youth Association is all his effort to make a change, to show to people that we have to consider this lagoon as a resourceful water or lagoon for the people live near. And what Errakor Bridge Youth Association is doing is very important to the community because they see that what we are doing is for the future generation.
But it's not enough. Now they're considering legal action. Chief Andrew says they've been asking the government to enforce existing environmental laws, but nothing's happened. Now they're getting legal advice to take court actions of their own.
Yes, we are thinking enough to blame the government into court because the hospital belongs to the government. And who can help us? There's nobody thinking that I will help you people to put the government out there. There's no one willing to come down like people that they have the big brains and all those to help people down there, the grassroots level. We need to fight this very slowly. We need to find funding somewhere to buy the lawyers and all those stuff.
The Director General of the Ministry of Health, Mr. Samuel Posikai Tapo, told Pacific Beat that construction company Grama Osinco has been contracted to fix the hospital sewage system. The government has allocated $350,000 for the work and it should be completed this year. Mr. Tapo said the ministry is looking for an additional $550,000 to transform the sewage system into a treatment plant. Villagers of Erakor Lagoon have been voicing their concerns since 2015 for the repairs, according to Chief Andrew. He's worried the government's announcement of repairs will turn out to be another false promise.
Since 2019, we've been sending some letters and some emails and through the Environment Department and to the Health Department of Health and all those. And they say, yeah, now they're sitting. They have sitting meetings and they're talking about and they're going to do it, but never things have done.
Chief Ken Andrew from Erakor Village ending Lealawanbu's story. In Samoa, there have been weeks of confusion after the government made changes to electoral laws affecting citizens living overseas. Initially, there was speculation the changes would allow the members of the diaspora to vote in the next general election, a huge change given more Samoans live overseas than in Samoa. But the government is stressing citizens living abroad will only be able to register to vote online. They will still have to come back to Samoa to physically cast their vote. Despite attempts at clarification, there's still plenty of confusion, as Adele Fruin reports from Apia.
Miracle Lungi runs a local store near the Apia airport, selling vegetables. She sees a lot of people come and go from Samoa, and she supports moves to give those living overseas a better chance to vote.
A lot of people say that our Samoan people living abroad do not have a right to vote, but they forget that these people they are talking about are real Samoans in the flesh and blood. They too are citizens here.
Despite heated debate last month, Samoa's government passed its electoral amendment bill. It says the bill will help with issues around voter re-registration and electoral roll maintenance in advance of the 2026 general elections. The amendments, it says, will remove the names of voters who have moved abroad permanently or are inactive. But in the community, confusion remains.
I believe that a lot of our people do not understand the new changes that have been passed.
Tavita Lave, an Apia local, says he's one of them.
As for myself, I don't really understand the new changes. Some say that overseas Samoans can now vote, while others say that it's just for registration.
The country's Minister for the Electoral Commission has since responded, clarifying in Parliament that only Samoan citizens can register to vote online, and they still have to return home for the 2026 election.
When people living overseas register online, they are still required to travel to Samoa for biometrics and further certification of residence before they are placed in the most appropriate constituency's electoral roll.
He also says that another requirement is proof of residence by a church minister or village mayor. However, Samoans living overseas say misinformation is still being spread online. And Nulua Fal'afa, a Samoan citizen living in New Zealand, says the government should look at making the voting system in Samoa easier first.
Why are we trying to reach people living far away, like New Zealand? What about our people in Samoa?
Legal expert Fuimaono Dylan Asafo says there is still confusion in community, and some of it is being spread by opposition MPs.
There are still very much legal requirements in place to ensure that only Samoan citizens who actually reside in Samoa can vote. And the recent law changes that Parliament passed this past month do not alter or remove these requirements. It's really important that all Samoans, including opposition MPs, actually take the time to read the law that was passed and understand the changes that have been made.
Most Pacific nations bar. Fiji requires its citizens to be in the country to vote. Solomon Islands goes to the polls next week. It requires its citizens to travel to its regional constituencies to vote. And Samoa allowing those living abroad to register online will be a first for the country. And Mr. Fuimono says the government should give an opportunity to Samoans to voice their concerns about these changes before passing them.
I think this controversy has shown that the government needs to be a lot more democratic and transparent around this issue of overseas registration and voting rights, and that they must invest in greater consultation efforts and public education initiatives moving forward.
Legal expert Fui Maono Dylan Asafo ending that report from Adele Fruin in Apia. Three young Papua New Guinean women have realised the phrase, "the sky is the limit," by training to become helicopter pilots flying humanitarian missions in remote parts of the country. It took time, determination and hard work to reach their dreams of flying, along with some progressive thinking by their employer. Hilda Wayne has the story.
Annette Gele was one of many young Papua New Guineans who wrote to Manolos Aviation, hoping to become a pilot. It was what she wrote in a job application that caught the attention of Manolos Aviation owner, Jürgen Ruh.
So this particular lady, Annette, she wrote to us and she said she always wanted to be a pilot. And I looked through her CV and I noticed that after school, she worked on the YWAM ship. And as a volunteer on the YWAM ship, I know you cannot just volunteer on the YWAM ship, you must actually pay to volunteer. So I was wondering, how did you manage to become a volunteer on the YWAM ship? And then she said, well, I wanted to work on the YWAM ship, so I wake up at 3 a.m, I bake muffins and I sold muffins in front of our house. And then I had some money, my parents helped me, and I used the money to be a volunteer on the YWAM ship. And that really was an eye-opener for me.
Mr. Ruh said, two other women, Dorothy Kay and Deborah Bidang, have also trained to become pilots with the hope of flying unassisted within 3 years.
The private pilot's license they have got is a first step in 100 miles. But having made that first step, I do know that, number one, they understand basic theory, and number two, they know how to fly a helicopter. So many people struggle with one or the other.
Annette says what they have achieved is not just for them and their families, but for the people they work to help.
For me, I think in Papua New Guinea, there's not a lot of opportunities for young girls to pursue this career. And it took a long time. And as far as I can remember, it's something that I always wanted to do, to fly, but it's quite expensive and the opportunities are not just available there for us. And it's not easy. It's very challenging. But what keeps me going is the thought that there are other young girls out there who don't have the opportunities that we do have.
Dorothy Kay says one of her biggest challenges was being overlooked as a female and waiting 2 years after graduation to be given a job.
Most of the boys we studied together, they got a job, but like a few girls, we started that trades. We didn't get an opportunity to work in the industry. Like, I was waiting for 2 years before I got the job offer from Manolos Aviation.
PNG women leader and gender advocate Grace Nari says it is encouraging for the fight for gender equality in PNG.
They make some of us proud. I know that our women and girls will make this gender equality a reality in this country when more of them tap into areas where it's been male dominated.
Dorothy Kay says she's looking forward to continue with Manolos Aviation and reaching rural communities of PNG.
I see myself as a commercial pilot helping our Mama Medivac program. Our helicopters, they go out to the rural areas and we go and we bring the mothers from the rural areas who have bad complications. So that's what I see myself doing as a pilot.
She says what Deborah Bidang, Annette Gele and herself have achieved so far is testament to discipline and commitment to work and encourages young women to do more for themselves.
There is a prevailing perception that aviation is a male-dominated field and people think that women are less capable of or suitable for certain roles within the industry. We can do what men do, you know. So my advice to the young girls in PNG is nothing is impossible as long as we set our mind to it and focus. We can achieve anything we want to do in life.
Pilot Dorothy Kay ending that report from Hilda Wayne. Finally, as a journalist, there's certain places you can't always walk freely with a camera. West Papua is one of them. And what happens within the Indonesian territory isn't always made public. But now, five new short films have just been released highlighting the gritty realities some West Papuans face. Carl Evans reports.
In most places, cheering on your national soccer team is a patriotic duty. But in a place like West Papua, Indonesian filmmaker Dandi Laksono says it's a bit more complex.
The soccer team is another culture and social issue because the repression of Indonesian government. Sometimes people express their nationality through the soccer team. So they support soccer team as if it's supporting the independence of the country. So it's quite interesting.
It's a story that's been rarely told. And it will be one of five films showcased in an upcoming West Papua mini film festival hosted by the University of Wollongong. The films are being produced by emerging filmmakers and journalists within West Papua, and Dandi has been assisting them to tell their story.
They are a good filmmaker and a good local journalist in West Papua, and then we work together to develop the storyline, the planning of production, because it is the first time Papuan journalists produce films.
The films shed light on several complex themes. They explore refugees, the Indonesian military, the 1969 referendum, as well as youth culture such as dance and hip-hop. Dandi says the films have been in production for 3 years.
Normally, we cannot just air this film in some public place or like public screening. We have to do it mostly outside Papua and do it quietly. Even in several big cities of Indonesia outside West Papua, we cannot screen this film like we publish in a normal occasion or normal event. So usually we just screen this film with a very small circle of audience, and then we discuss it. And this time we tried to reach out the audience in Australia, in 9 cities in Australia. For the first time, we will feel free to hold some public screening.
The films will premiere at the University of Wollongong on April 9, before being played in Canberra, Adelaide, Brisbane and Hobart. Cammy Webb-Gannon, a Pacific decolonisation researcher at the University of Wollongong, says the event aims to address a misinformation problem in West Papua.
Over the past few years, we've seen Indonesia essentially like double down on trying to distribute propaganda about West Papua, that everything's fine in West Papua. They've developed AI personas, journalists who are spreading propaganda, they've created Facebook profiles for them and Twitter profiles, other social media profiles for these fake personas who are then talking about West Papua and how the government of Indonesia is doing great things in West Papua and how the Papuans who want independence are traitors. So in the context of this and the fact that it's very difficult for foreign media to get into West Papua and it's very difficult for media to subjectively cover events in West Papua, we thought that it would be a good idea for some short films are around 1 hour each to be made about what is actually happening in West Papua.
She says the films aren't meant to be anti-Indonesia or pro-independence. They aim to merely shed light on the gritty reality of life.
When we do hear news coming out of Papua, it's tragedy. We hear about torture. We hear about trauma. We hear about massacres. We hear about starvation. We hear about genocide. And some of these films do have a focus on the atrocities that take place in West Papua, but they also speak to the resilience and the courage of West Papuan people, to their creativity and to their ability to sustain their cultures and to maintain hope.
Dandi says West Papua is not a place where people can walk freely with a camera. But now, another country will get to see what life is like.
Maybe for the first time, they have comprehensive information and perspective, not only about political and classic military stories, but also what is actual impact on daily basis of society with very various perspective and very various issues in the field.
That was Indonesian filmmaker Dandi Laksono, ending that report by Kyle Evans. And that's it for this week's Pacific Review. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific. Pacific Review was produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.